Every now and then Simon Starling comes visits Turin. By now, he must know the city. In the last few years, he productively got inspired by some of those people who have shaped its modern and modernist facade. Carlo Mollino above all. It was time to meet Mario Merz and let their two practices resonate. In that subtle, poetic constellation of meanings and forms and stories, Starling's work is very much about.
Turin has been a very kind of productive place for me to work the last 10 years or so since I started working with the gallery here, Franco Nuero. And there's various kind of local stories, local characters that have played a part in works that I've developed here. So as you said, Molino, who, you know, is a very particular Turin character, kind of appears in a couple of the works, and I also made a work very specifically in relation to the what's known as the Fetta di Polenta, the strange slice of a building that Antonelli built here from the remains of a kind of semi-demolished building. I like Turin very much because it's a place where people are still making things, which is quite rare in contemporary cities. Actually, there's a sort of degree of, you know, there's still craftsmen sort of working in back courtyards in the city, and it's been very kind of inspiring and productive. A palette of material and processes and techniques and stories as well, which has sort of fed into my work a lot. And Mario Merz, I suppose, is he's an artist who I've known since studying back in the 80s, I suppose, but the group of artists that he sort of very much became part of, the Arti Povera artists, have always sort of been kind of pretty intriguing, but I'd never had any sort of real direct kind of contact with his work professionally. But yeah, so it was nice to kind of get this opportunity to sort of rethink his work in a way and sort of try and establish a sense of a sort of relationship between him and my own practice. They're very different art practices, I would say. They're very much marked by, a different sort of generation gap somehow. But at the same time, I think there's some sort of resonances, some sort of approaches. He was somebody who often, like myself, very much responded to particular sites, to particular architecture, kind of working on the hoof very much. I mean, it was a studio-based practice in some sense, but it was also very, very sort of responsive, and that I find kind of interesting. I mean, I suppose the studio as a place of production has never been so important to me. It's more of a kind of place of coordination and planning and thinking, and a lot of the work gets made sort of in the real world, so to say. So from that point of view, I've sort of found that relationship interesting, and also his kind of relationship to technology, his sort of, and science, is something that intrigued me about him as well. I mean, he approached that in a very sort of poetic fashion somehow, which perhaps is a little different to my own approach, but his questioning, his sort of skepticism of technology and this, he sort of urges us in a way to allow sort of contemporary art practice to sort of always be in a way sort of a little bit resistant to technology, to be constantly sort of questioning its influence. And I think that's one of the things that I tried to pick up on in the exhibition. What I've tried to do in the exhibition is to sort of in a way look at this kind of space between a kind of conception of an idea and its realization, and the sorts of slippages that can occur in that space, how that becomes a sort of creative force or something in the making of the work. I mean, that's probably best embodied in Sture Johannesson, the Malmo-based artist. While he's kind of best known for his sort of psychedelic posters from the 60s and 70s, he also made this very beautiful set of computer drawings of leaves at a time when you actually couldn't see what you were doing. You had no screen, and you were feeding information into the computer as sort of punched cardboard cards. So it was a very speculative, blind drawing in a way. Yeah, he made like 40 or so attempts to draw a cannabis leaf with the help of a programmer from IBM. And the results are really amazing things, I think. I think he was an ex-school teacher or something, Stan Kalin, who is working for IBM this in his sort of suit and tie. And then this kind of hippie, Sture Johannesson. And then also the plotter, which seems to become, in a way, a kind of third party in the collaboration, this rather temperamental printing device, very rudimentary printing device, which also sort of added to the conversation somehow between them. So yeah, it's a very nice way to dramatize that shift at that particular moment. I mean, it's a work that I saw for the first time about 10 years ago or something, and I've always thought it'd be nice to include. And then, you know, there's other pieces that I've brought into the exhibition, like these amazing images of the moon, which were made by two amateur astronomers in the 19th century. They had no way of photographing the moon in any detail, so they came up with this wonderful process whereby they spent years making very, very detailed drawings from their observations through a telescope, and then turned those drawings into models, plaster models of the moon surface, and then they put those models into the sun, just as the moon is in the sun, and photographed them, and then presented them as, in a sense, scientific illustrations for their book, which was published in 1874 about the moon. So again, it's this sort of third hand information that mutates as it goes through this process, and it creates these very, very beautiful, very, I don't know, science fiction like kind of images, which is very exciting and definitely has a sort of resonance in relation to the other works in the exhibition.
Slippages, when ideas and technology go at a different speed. Slippages, when ideas come first. Slippages, when ideas become a third and moon. Slippages, when ideas bend technology to a speculative exercise. Entering the main gallery at the Merz Foundation, under a blue Spanish sky, one first encounters a large and welcoming double igloo-shaped sculpture by Mario Merz, representing the moon and the earth rotating around their own axis. All around the sculpture, along the perimetric wall, there is a series of photographic reproduction of the moon. Around the corner, one might end up reading the mysterious story of a lost meteorite. From the Earth to the extraterrestrial space, the exhibition seems to follow a circular conceptual and physical path.
I've made quite a lot of solo exhibitions in my life now. I'm more and more interested in finding kind of different ways of working and collaborating and sort of fusing sort of art making with curating and in a way thinking about those things as one and the same in a way, so they're not different disciplines but rather part of one project somehow. And somehow I felt from the beginning when I was invited to work on the show here that I wanted to sort of break this very particular construct of Mario Merz, the sort of dead, very famous artist, and then the younger artist, and that sort of constellation in a way, both kind of in a way feeding off each other in different ways, and it's sort of, I don't know, strange Frankenstein-like sort of constellation somehow. And so I thought, it was nice to sort of break that and introduce other artists, other works, and think about it more as a process of curating, selecting, than just a sort of another solo exhibition or two-person exhibition. So that was an important sort of first step. And then I suppose I kind of gravitated towards this work that they have in the collection of Mario's, of the movement of the Earth and the Moon around an axis, which is these two kind of igloos, which of course can be read as planets in relation to the title, I suppose. And that somehow becomes a sort of notional gravitational center for the exhibition. I mean, it's very central in the exhibition, but and the other works kind of, in a way, orbit around that. It's very much the largest work in the show. And so you have these very fine, small, Victorian scientific photographs that orbit around it on the outside wall of the exhibition space. This other work of mine, these three lumps of marble which hang from the ceiling, almost as if they're in orbit around the Mertz work. And so it became a sort of center, both conceptually but also sort of physically, for thinking about how to construct the exhibition.
That, in a way, seems to be structure around the idea of a cabinet, a scientific cabinet.
I suppose so. For me, the exciting thing about the exhibition is that it's sort of pulling in lots of different directions, and I think it's an exhibition that will take people some time to see, and maybe they have to come back. And it's a sort of slow process, I think, because it does function on many levels. I mean, there are these very immediate levels that we've been talking about the sort of idea of a constellation of objects or the planetary relationships or whatever that are there very clearly. You have meteorites, falling in Argentina, and scientists in England trying to recreate the surface of the moon, and Mario Mertz speculating on the kind of relationship between those two, the moon and the earth. And so those things are there immediately, but then there are these sort of other levels of thinking, I suppose, in the way the show which was put together, which are perhaps, less immediate. And you mean a sort of cabinet of curiosities or something like Wunderkammer? It's almost, this sort of 19th century approach to juxtaposing things from very different areas, almost sort of forcing relationships but in a very sort of speculative way. I've always been a big fan of the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, which is sort of an anthropological museum, but structured in such a bizarre way. It has no sort of sense in terms of that science, but somehow it's wonderful, kind of rich experience that's doing something very different to a traditional kind of or a contemporary anthropological museum. And I suppose there is a sense of that in what's happening here.
Among the other artists selected by Starling, Guillermo Fajvovic and Nicholas Golbe's work is worthy of attention. In the last 5 years, they have been working to piece together the complex scientific and cultural history of the Campo del Cielo meteorites.
It's a huge undertaking. They sort of set out 5 years ago now to try and, in a way, track the life of all of the meteorites that fell in Chaco 4,000 years ago. They're all meteorites that have, these very different, very particular stories. And they're stories that sort of resonate in relation to colonial politics, in relation to sort of the evolution of science. But it's a sort of very grand, in a way, undertaking. There's a lot of talk in contemporary art about research, but actually I think there are very, very few artists who are really doing research in the sense of really unearthing kind of new information and really, really changing the sense of what's been kind of mapped. And they're really doing that in this project. It's very, very rigorous, and they're really somehow, as artists, able to do things perhaps that the scientists involved in that world are not able to do, and connect things in a way that the scientists are not able to do. It's kind of generating a very kind of rich, very slowly unfolding kind of body of work. And, that's been kind of manifest in in a very simple but very beautiful exhibition in Frankfurt last September, where they brought together two halves of a meteorite that were cut in Germany and sort of investigated the politics and this very simple act of reuniting these two parts, one of which was sent back to Argentina and left to kind of rust in the garden of the planetarium in Buenos Aires, and the other which was kept sort of secretively in a way in storage. Probably shouldn't have been there, but they kept it at the Smithsonian. And when Guillermo and Nico went to sort of ask about the other half of the Smithsonian, they kind of feigned ignorance in a way. And it was only a few days later that somebody came forward and said, "Oh yeah, we've got it here." And so there's a lot of sort of gamesmanship or something in that world. And so they're really using, you know, this very specific scientific world to talk to a very contemporary, I think, situation, and using very contemporary sort of strategies to do that too.
It is almost impossible not to figure out a kind of adventurous enthusiasm. There is a sense of discovery in their practice, a sort of reenactment of a dreamlike expedition that pulls together their practice to Starling's one.
We made an interview, Guillermo, Nico and I, in four or five different locations in Argentina last year, just before that exhibition in Frankfurt, and it was kind of palpable, their sort of excitement. We sort of flew up to Chaco in the north of Argentina and drove on this crazy dirt track through the region to the site where there's a real sense of almost rediscovering a sort of an energy in that kind of exploration, that kind of research. But they do it in a very, very nice way, really establishing relationships with the local people, and it's very genuine somehow. But you're right, there is a sort of boyish kind of fascination. I mean, I think that also that's just in the nature of that whole world somehow, the sort of, as kids, they were both inspired by 2001, A Space Odyssey, and you know that it is also about that kind of stargazing, kind of speculation, which is perhaps a little bit teenage in a way. In some sense, all of that material is out there in the world, but what I'm, I suppose, trying to do is to sort of again, it's perhaps the image of the constellation is a good one. The idea of trying to hold all these different stories in the same sort of constellation momentarily, perhaps, that they kind of giving them some sort of gravitational attraction, and making often stories which seem very, very, or histories that seem very, very disparate sort of stick together, so that you can kind of rethink them all. And I think actually the film that you're talking about downstairs, Project for a Masquerade, Hiroshima, which was made earlier this year, is a sort of a very good example of that. You know, it takes the story of a kind of commissioning of a sculpture by Chicago University from Henry Moore in the 1960s as a sort of a marker for the first sustainable nuclear reaction that Fermi produced in 1942, which of course led to the atom bomb project, and it takes that as a sort of core, and then looks at that through the device of a piece of 16th century no theatre, which are not things you would normally connect with each other, and then sort of recasts that play, that no play, with a number of kind of figures, both historical and fictional, from that moment, the 60s, the kind of Cold War moment. So you have Anthony Blunt, who's this kind of infamous art historian stroke spy who was working for the Queen and the KGB in the same breath. And, you know, you have James Bond from Goldfinger playing a gold merchant in the play. And you have the bad guys played by Joseph Hirshhorn, the art collector and uranium mogul who made his fortune from, in a way, the beginnings of the Cold War. And it's a kind of playful attempt to sort of, I don't know, think about a specific moment of art history in a way, but in a very much expanded field. And I think that that Cold War moment is kind of very interesting to me at the moment somehow. I don't know. You know, I was born in the late 60s, and my sort of political conscience was established at that time in the, you know, in the 70s, 80s, when all of that was kind of unfolding. The famous outing of Anthony Blunt in 1979 by Margaret Thatcher, and you know, it's all sort of, it's part of my upbringing somehow. So, yeah.
A prominent character of the Cold War years was Henry Moore, the sculptor, whose role in the international field Starling had been questioning a lot in the recent past.
Henry Moore's monumental sculpture, Nuclear Energy, started life in December 1963, some months before the approach from the Chicago Commission, as a tiny plaster maquette with clear links to F.H.
Probably this Hiroshima project is probably the end of my dealings with him for a while, but it's not that I have a sort of burning passion for his work specifically, but he's a very interesting figure in that he had this extraordinary global success in the 60s and 70s. His work was, you know, installed everywhere. Consequently, he kind of became kind of caught up in all of that sort of political maneuvering, and I guess instrumentalized in a way by, you know, the British establishment and by others too. But he's a very interesting figure, and it's very, I've always tried to find these different ways of mapping my own travels, my own activities in the world. And in the beginning of my career, I sort of used international modernist architecture as a way to sort of coordinate myself or to orientate myself in the world. And Moore, in a way, functions in a little bit the same way, because he's there before you get there. Moore's always there. You know, I made this Muscled Moore project in Toronto, and Moore has a huge presence in the art world in the city in Toronto, and it was a way to locate myself on arrival somehow. I knew about that and his importance there, and so he always got there first somehow with some big bronze thing, and it's been a very sort of productive relationship with him over the last few years. But maybe I'll sort of back off from that for a while. I don't want to be the artist who makes work about Henry Moore. It's also because of a sort of, there's been this sort of gap now of, you know, what, 20 years or something since the end of the Cold War, and I don't know, it seems like it's now a moment to look back at that and to think about that again, and also of course a lot of material from that time, like for example the Anthony Blunt archives, which were always secret, have now been sort of made available to the public, and so there's certain things which are kind of opening up for the first time that make it a sort of interesting area for sort of study too. I think, and it's also just, as I was saying, this sort of sense of, it's almost in your, as a sort of 40-something-year-old artist, it's almost in your makeup, your genes or something, your sort of, yeah, your political formation or something. It's part of that, and it's, you know, yeah.
This interview was recorded on the occasion of the Inaccessible Poem, a project by Simon Starling, curated by Maria Centonze, at the Fondazione Merz, Turin. If you'd like to support Radio Papesse, visit radiopapesse.org.